Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Taliban in Kabul's broad daylight. A coordinated attack in the center of Kabul, Afghanistan, with suicide bombers, car bombers, and insurgents with rifles. Civilians on the run, the Afghan government on the ropes, and a setback for the U.S. and NATO on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Monday, January 18th, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. The Takeaway this morning is a bold attack in Afghanistan's capital and the tragedy continuing to unfold in Haiti after last week's earthquake. Joining me is Miles O'Brien this morning and all week for the vacationing Celeste Headlee. Good morning, Miles.
Good to be with you, John. Let's get right to those top stories you're talking about. The streets of Kabul were a battlefield this morning. A group of armed Taliban militants, some wearing suicide bombing vests, tried to storm the presidential palace and other government buildings. They fanned out, taking up positions on rooftops before Afghan troops were able to take some control of the situation hours later.
We spoke to a BBC correspondent earlier this morning, Mark Dummett, who was trapped in one of those hotels there in the center city of Kabul. And I asked him whether he and other international news reporters were targeted in this raid.
The hotel where we are staying is right in the heart of things, as it were. It's in Kabul's small city center, which is home to the presidential palace and government ministries. We know the fighting has spread from one place to the other around us, from a shopping center. We hear of fighting in the Ministry of Finance, and now we understand there's fighting in a cinema, which is on the other side of the hotel.
So this has to be incredibly demoralizing to what there was of a National Guard.
These attacks are becoming more and more coordinated. Of course, this isn't the first attack on Kabul. The city residents have got fairly used to suicide attacks. They do happen every other month or so, but you know, this attack is much bigger in scale, obviously, because it involves more people, suicide attackers and gunmen, and car bombers. So the nature of that threat is obviously a worry, will obviously be a worry to the Afghan government and to the U.S. and NATO forces who are based here.
He's under something of a siege there in Kabul earlier this morning, BBC correspondent Mark Dummett.
Officials say at least five people were killed and nearly 40 wounded. Seven of the attackers were also killed. The situation ongoing. On to Haiti now, where in the past 15 minutes, the European Union pledged nearly $600 million to help those affected by last week's earthquake. Meanwhile, thousands of U.S. troops are expected to arrive off the coast of Haiti's devastated city of Port-au-Prince today to help relief organizations get supplies to survivors. They'll also be reinforcing 1,000 U.S. troops already on the ground. Lieutenant General Ken Keene, Deputy Commander of U.S. Southern Command, says the security condition remains difficult.
We've had incidents of violence that impede our ability to support the government of Haiti.
Some election hits now. The fate of President Obama's health care overhaul could depend on who will fill the Massachusetts Senate seat left vacant by Edward Kennedy's death. Special election on Tuesday. The president was there over the weekend.
Asian markets down. European indices up slightly. Here at home, the markets closed for the MLK holiday. Coming up, parents, do you wonder the best way to talk to your kids about scary or tragic events like the Haiti earthquake? Later in the hour, we'll find out how parents can help their kids channel anxieties into positive outcomes. As the nation commemorates the life and work of the civil rights leader, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Our God is marching on. Yeah. Glory, hallelujah.
Yes, sir.
Glory.
We're asking our listeners, how far as a nation have we come in realizing Dr. King's dreams? What parts of his vision have we accomplished? But also, how much more work needs to be done? Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment on our website, thetakeaway.org.
I think one of the best ways we can honor Dr. King today is to get food and water as soon as possible to the people of Haiti, especially the children.
877-8-MY-TAKE. That's how you reach us. Coming up, more on Haiti. Good morning, everyone. I'm here with Miles O'Brien, who's in for the vacationing Celeste Headlee all week. Good morning, Miles.
Good to be here.
You know, I don't know if you watched or took a look at the coverage from Haiti over the weekend, but each individual story of people reaching out for help, the help not arriving, was, I think, emblematic of a huge story. You can't really even put into context the number 100,000, which is what they're saying, and the death toll is going
to be. It's very difficult to get a sense of the magnitude of the problem and the tragedy there, I think.
And each one of the stories, it both tells a tiny slice and tells it all. And we've been relying on the remarkable team of reporters we have on the ground in Port-au-Prince from our colleagues, the BBC. Listen to Mark Doyle speaking with, having a conversation which is tragic and sadly typical.
Any medical attention here?
Any doctors, nurses? Nothing at all. We don't have no aid, no nothing at all. No food, no water, no medical, no doctor, nothing at all. You are the first one who visit us, sir.
Mark Doyle, the first one to visit that community of people waiting for aid. The people in Port-au-Prince and around Haiti, in the wake of last week's earthquake, are fending for themselves. Jean-Yvan Kernizan, Haitian-American, survivor of the earthquake, what's it like to know that you're on your own?
It's actually very hard, especially in the first hours of the tragedy. We were hoping that the people from the United Nations, the minister, would be of assistance to the people. But up until we left on Thursday night, we had not seen one single soldier even directing traffic.
Well, Jean-Yvan Kernizan is a Haitian-American survivor in our studio who was there during the earthquake, as you just mentioned, arrived back here late last week. Also in the studio with us is Selena Ryan, a survivor, a friend of Jean. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So, first of all, Jean, just explain the story that happened to you. I mean, where were you when the earthquake hit, and just how did it unfold over the days before you decided to leave?
We got home a bit late, and we were having a late lunch when it happened. And all of a sudden, it's like the whole table moved, hit the china that is next to it, and it took me a few seconds to realize what was going on. And with the help of the friends that they have a little more experience in earthquake, being from California.
Right.
And we formed a chain. There were five of us, and we formed a chain and to get out, because you couldn't do it on your own. It was so, everything was like moving around.
And what happened to your home?
Thank God the home is still standing. We may have to assess the structural damage, but the home is still standing.
But because it was still standing, Selena, it became the obvious location for a makeshift hospital, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly. We soon after it happened, we opened the gate into the courtyard, and people started streaming in from the neighborhood who were injured and needed help. So we did what we could with the small amounts of medical supplies we had, like a bottle of hydrogen peroxide and some bandages and
how many people?
Water. I think within the amount of time, up to 200 people came through at some point.
One bottle of hydrogen peroxide and some...
And a bottle of alcohol. We actually had two bottles. We found another bottle in the house.
Yeah. What emotionally are your colleagues, your compatriots going through in Haiti as you've seen these stories and watched the coverage since you returned?
I think one thing that is very therapeutic for the people, especially the young people, is the fact that they were the one helping. Because you sense that when you are in a lot of pain and you're helping other people that are in pain, your pain kind of diminishes. And this is what happened to us and to a lot of people that were helping. At one point, you didn't matter anymore. It was more like, because we had no gloves, for example. And you know all the risk associated with dealing with blood and not having a gloves on. But it didn't matter. You see, the important thing was to be able to provide a little bit of assistance to the people that were injured.
People in Haiti are used to fending for themselves in this situation. And while that is heroic, it also points up the real abandonment of Haiti on the part of the infrastructure, which really should be there. How does the UN stack up? They took a terrible hit last week, but nevertheless, are they to be relied on here, Selena?
I think in my experience, being in Haiti before the earthquake hit, as we were talking to a lot of people, the sense of the UN presence there is not a positive one, even before this happened. And we were able to see that firsthand, that when the earthquake hit, they were nowhere to be found to give any assistance. And even though they were hit hard, as everyone else was, you know, they're soldiers and they should be expected. They're trained to be in these kinds of situations and need to be of assistance. They're trained for that.
And Selena Ryan talking about the peacekeepers who were nowhere to be found. Of course, again, we mentioned that they took a big hit themselves as a result of the earthquake. But Jean-Yvan Kernison, what about the police force in Haiti? What about the government?
It was about the same thing. We finally saw them. It was at the first gas station. We were trying to get some gas, and they came, blocked everything, and it's like kicked everybody out and took all that was available.
You're incredibly lucky to be here in the studio. How did you get out? How were you able to get out?
Well, and I like to take a second to thank the people of Fort McGuire, the base there, mm-hmm. Air Force Base at Fort McGuire. They were really, really amazing. I mean, they went out of their way to make us comfortable. We got out. We were on the second plane that left Haiti.
Wow.
And we started early. The thing is, at one point when we had nothing else, no more supplies, we thought that it would be easier if we came and let people know what's going on in order for the people of Haiti to get, for things to be moving bit quicker, because it was so slow. And up until we left on Thursday night, no one had received not even a bottle of water.
Well, basically, based on your experience, and we're going to leave it here, but 12,000 U.S. troops will be on the ground by the end of today. That's a positive thing?
And what I'm hoping is that they are there for the people, not to protect a segment of the population.
Right. Well, you're evoking a complicated history between the U.S. and Haiti. Jean-Yvan Kernison, Haitian-American survivor of the earthquake last week, along with Selena Ryan, both were in Haiti and returned late last week. And now at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on the headlines we're following.
Afghanistan's President Karzai says order has been restored to the heart of the capital city, Kabul. That's after a deadly gun battle involving Taliban militants. At least 5 people are dead. Back to Haiti now. The U.S. says it's working aggressively to speed up deliveries of aid there. But as this man tells our partner BBC, things on the ground are still catastrophic.
I've seen some dead bodies being burned just in a corner, and it seems to be just casual because people just keep on driving or walking in front of them, and then you see people just sleeping everywhere.
It's horrifying, but there are some glimmers of hope. A UN spokeswoman says more than 1,700 rescue workers have saved over 70 lives since the quake. Late last night, U.S. teams with search dogs rescued a 16-year-old Dominican girl trapped for 5 days in a collapsed hotel. One survivor, Rick Santos, says his group went through a wide range of emotions while buried beneath the Montana Hotel.
Despair and the elation were at different moments. And, you know, I think when it first hit, we were like, okay, we're trapped, but we're alive. And that's something. And so now the question is, how do you stay alive?
Here in the U.S., President Obama was stumping in Boston yesterday for the Democratic candidate, Martha Coakley, who is in a very, very tough race to succeed the late Ted Kennedy. And the Turkish man who shot Pope John Paul II in 1981 was released from prison today. Spent 29 years behind bars. That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, the life and work of Martin Luther King Jr.
Hey, you want that to go?
Welcome back to the program. I'm Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee on vacation this week. Let's have some takeouts now, shall we? Stories we're following this week. Let's start with Washington, a takeout on Haiti. Here's Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Todd, good morning to you.
Hi, good morning, Miles.
You were on a conference call and got a good overview of what the U.S. is attempting to do to help out Haiti. And we're told this morning 12,000 troops on the way. Give us the big picture here on what the U.S. is doing to try to help.
Yeah, the U.S. State Department, USAID, and the military briefing reporters from the U.S. Embassy in Port-au-Prince yesterday, Miles. Just an update on search and rescue. Now, as of yesterday afternoon, the United States said that international search and rescue had pulled 61 people alive from the rubble in Port-au-Prince. Now, we also understood that yesterday an additional 3 people had been pulled from that Caribbean market that collapsed in the middle of town. There's a little bit of confusion around town, of course, as to exactly how many people had been pulled alive. 29 of these people, according to the U.S. government, were Americans. Now, today, Monday, the U.S. makes pains to say that the Haitian government is in the lead here, but the United States, the State Department, and USAID saying that at some time today, the decision will probably be made, the, quote, difficult decision, to move this operation from search and rescue to recovery, meaning starting to assume that no one else is left alive in the rubble and moving this to a recovery operation. Unclear when that will happen, but they say that will happen at some point today.
All right.
I'll bring you, yeah,
tell
please.
Us about the troops, 12,000 troops. What's on the ground there right now? It's so chaotic. All the numbers are hard to keep track of here.
It's chaotic. The numbers are hard to keep track of. Most of those 12,000 are either on the way or on ships. There are not nearly as many American boots on the ground, probably closer to 1,000 or less. Those troops will probably have primarily the responsibility of securing food and water distribution sites. There is still a little bit of confusion, or at least there was as of yesterday, between the Haitian government, the UN, and the United States as to what exactly the role of those troops will be. Reporters were asking the colonel in charge of controlling the airport there, and by the way, the military is controlling the airport, why more U.S. boots aren't on the ground, why they're on ships on the Vincent and other ships in the harbor or off the coast. He said they have had to prioritize food and water coming in on planes versus troops. You got to prioritize those, and there's only so many landings at the airport that are possible, about 60 a day.
Our last takeout marks Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. This weekend, WNYC Radio hosted a celebration for the holiday at the Brooklyn Museum in New York. Our own Celeste Headlee, on vacation this week, co-hosted the event. This morning, we're bringing you some of the prominent civil rights activists she spoke to.
I'm Dr. Roscoe C. Brown Jr., former president of Bronx Community College and a former Tuskegee Airman, and a lifetime advocate for racial justice, fairness, and equality.
So, on this Martin Luther King Day of this year, maybe you could tell us what part of Dr. King's vision has been realized? What do we still have yet to accomplish?
The part about legal segregation has been realized. When people say we're in a post-racial society, I say we're in a post-segregation society, because many of the things that legally were done against black people can't be done now. But there's still a tremendous amount of covert racism in our society.
You come from a generation that maybe many people don't remember or have touch with now, and I'm wondering if you could kind of give us an example of something to help us understand how far we've come since the days of your childhood.
Well, how far we've come, I grew up in Washington, D.C. in a middle-class black neighborhood, but I had to walk past 2 white high schools to go to the famed Dunbar High School, which happened to be better, but it was segregated, and we could not go to the white schools. Similarly, many times when we would travel, we could not stop to eat in a restaurant. They want you to go to the back and take food out from the back. We couldn't ride in certain parts of the train. So that type of legal segregation really has ended. But the kind of covert segregation where people are denied jobs is still there.
That was Dr. Roscoe Brown, a professor at City University of New York, with Celeste Headlee. He is a former Tuskegee Airman.
So our sports takeaway, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, takeaway sports contributor. Against all odds, the Jets beat the Chargers. And I have to figure that this is a morning for that sports fan, that Jets fan, that little kid Jets fan who believed despite all the analysts counting out the Jets.
It's true. And while most of the time we spend a lot of time talking about quarterbacks, Mark Sanchez is not the leader of this team. The leader is another rookie whose name we're going to know now, is a guy named Sean Green. It is Sean Green's offense. He has been the running back that has led this Jets rushing attack in the playoffs, and he's unstoppable. A couple other names, Kerry Rhodes and Darrell Revis. Who are those
Revis
guys?
Revis on the defense,
they're
right.
The two top defenders on the Jets in the secondary that went up against a Chargers wide receiver core that was really almost better than the Colts, who they're going to face next week. That's a better wide receiving core than they're going to face next week. So I would argue that the Jets face one of the best wide receiving cores in the league, and they stopped them.
And in this particular game, and really the last two games, the Jets have been able to establish their running game, which means they are a threat on the ground,
correct,
which intimidates the defense. That's going to be a storyline for the game against the Colts next week,
it's
right?
True. What they were able to do, there was one touchdown where they ran the ball, and then they bootleg, which means that the quarterback faked the run, and then he pulled out, he rolled to the right, and then he threw a pass. That is the basic formula for winning football. With the Indianapolis Colts, they have a porous running defense, and the Jets will be able to exploit that.
Well, the Jets beat the Chargers 17-14. Other scores, Minnesota over Dallas in a humiliation 34-3. Saints beat the Cardinals 45-14, another humiliation, and the Colts beat the Ravens 20-3. So, you know, you called this Jets game win. This is the one long shot. Everything else was a blowout this weekend. But you called this Jets game. Am I not correct?
You're correct, but I think it's hilarious that I called it. However, if the Chargers hadn't missed three field goals in this game,
yeah, that's true.
If they hadn't missed two, then they would have won the game.
So I got to figure you're that kid, sports fan, that this day is made for. Who everyone else counted out the Jets, but you're wandering around with a smile on your face saying, I believe.
J-E-T-S, Jets.
Disclosing his bias and the fact that he'll have to recuse himself.
But
I am
a Giants
NFL
fan. I am a Giants fan.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports.
Good morning.
Coming up, the agenda. Coming up, a look at this week's agenda, and center stage in the agenda for President Obama is that special election for the Senate seat in Massachusetts. We're going to talk about everything the Obama administration faces this week. But first, let's check in on top stories at 30 minutes after the hour. You're listening right now to sound of gunfire echoing in the streets of Kabul this morning after a group of armed Taliban militants tried to storm the presidential palace and other government buildings. U.S. Special Envoy for Afghanistan Richard Holbrooke said the Taliban will not win no matter how many attacks it launches.
It's not surprising that the Taliban do this sort of thing. They're desperate people. They're ruthless. The people who are doing this certainly will not survive the attack, nor will they succeed. But we can expect this sort of thing on a regular basis. That is who the Taliban are.
Five people were killed, at least 40 wounded. Seven of the attackers were also killed. On to Haiti, where the heartbreak continues to permeate Port-au-Prince.
I don't have house. I don't have anything. I don't have food. I don't have water to drink.
And Kenneth Merton, the U.S. ambassador to Haiti, tells NBC News he has no idea how much it's going to cost to rebuild Haiti.
It's an incredible situation. Downtown Port-au-Prince looks, as I imagine, Tokyo looked after the Second World War. It is flattened.
The European Union this morning pledged nearly $600 million to the relief effort.
The five Americans being held in Pakistan on suspicion of terrorism had this to say as they were being driven from court today. Police and prison authorities are denying any mistreatment, however. The five Americans were detained in December after being accused of plotting terror attacks in Pakistan and having links to Al-Qaeda. At the Golden Globes last night, Avatar won Best Film
big
Drama.
Surprise.
Yeah,
big surprise.
Well, actually, yeah, it did surprise some people. James Cameron took home Best Director. I guess if the film wins, he gets that,
yeah, right?
And Meryl Streep with her, what was it, seventh?
Seventh Golden Globe.
Playing Julia Child in Julia and Julia. Robert Downey Jr. winning for Sherlock Holmes. As for the markets, Asian markets down, European indices up, and the U.S. markets are off today for the MLK holiday. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Our government.
Iran.
Your government.
Proliferation.
Public option.
A serious insurgency.
We do have a plan. We're working on it.
Just to give you a sense of perspective.
So the headlines go right into the agenda this morning. Rob Watson, political correspondent for the BBC in London, and Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partners, the New York Times. They joined us earlier this morning, and right off the top, I asked Rob about the implications of this Afghanistan attack.
Well, I think it's obviously a worrying development. This looks like, although it's still early stages, one of the most sophisticated attacks that the Taliban have mounted yet in the Afghan capital. And one thing that I did after the attack started was to just look up the figures as to the deteriorating security. And I went to dig up the GAO, the good old reliable government accountability office. You've got to go with their stats. And just to note this, from January to August of 2009, there were 13,000 attacks on civilians, coalition forces and Afghan forces. That was 2.5 times greater than the same period 2008. And obviously a lot up, 5 times up on 2,500 attacks in 2005. So I think you can see this as really part of a very worrying deterioration in the security.
Well, whether it will be viewed as a kind of Vietnam Tet offensive in its boldness and brazenness as far as the Obama administration and NATO is concerned, we will have to see. Marcus Mabry, here in the United States, there is a very, very tense standoff, a contest in Massachusetts that the entire Obama agenda may hinge on. Explain.
Martha Coakley, the Democratic nominee to take over Ted Kennedy's venerated seat, the Democrats have venerated, and even some Republicans have venerated it in the United States Senate, is, you know, up against Scott Brown, the Republican state senator. And right now, in some polls, he's leading her.
And here is the president speaking at a campaign rally on Sunday.
If you were fired up in the last election, I need you more fired up in this election. I need you out there working just as hard right now in those final days.
I don't know, Marcus Mabry. He sounds all in.
Oh,
there in
he's all in, and he's scared to death.
And it took them by surprise that this was going to be a cliffhanger. Yes,
and it shouldn't have, because although we all think of Massachusetts as, you know, the People's Republic of Massachusetts, a very left-leaning blue state, the bluest of blue. The fact is, although Democrats outnumber Republicans 3-1 in that state, they're actually, the majority of the people in Massachusetts are actually unaffiliated. They don't believe in either party, so it's a much more independent state.
A little bit more like New Hampshire,
exactly, than we suspect. However, none of that will matter. None of that reality will matter if the Democrats lose this seat. Health care will be imperiled, and Obama will have to readjust his entire agenda.
And the Republicans are already positioning themselves. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says we've already won.
Regardless of the outcome Tuesday, we know that in the most liberal state in America, you're going to have a close election for the United States Senate because people in Massachusetts don't want this health care bill to pass.
All right. Is he right?
No, he's not right, because it's about a lot more than that. You wouldn't expect him to say anything else. And the fact is, if the Republicans don't win the seat, then they don't win the seat. It will make a huge difference. The Democrats will still have their supermajority of 60 and will still run through with their health care plan.
How much is the international agenda of the Obama presidency on the line with the relief effort in Haiti now taking center stage? Marcus Mabry, and then I want to check with Rob Watson.
Well, again, you know, I think politically the Republicans have tried to make this Obama's New Orleans. The fact is, it's not New Orleans. It's not an American city. I was in Haiti last 15 years ago with American soldiers who were coming in at that point to restore Jean-Bertrand Aristide to power. Haiti is the great shame of the Western Hemisphere. It has been before. It will remain after. I think the question right now is one of personal relief, one of humanity and humanitarian relief, and that's what the administration has to rise up to. It's not really a political thing. I don't think it's going to affect the larger international agenda, but it will affect their image as caring and a different American leadership.
Rob Watson, do you think there's a clock ticking on the international community coming to the aid of Haiti, or will this sort of pass?
Well, I think there's a clock ticking in terms of the immediate requirements.
Indeed.
And clearly, they're pretty intense, and the international community is struggling. I don't think it's necessarily fair to criticize the international community when you think that the actual port in Port-au-Prince has gone, that the roads aren't great, the roads that there are absolutely clogged with traffic. So it's no easy matter. I guess there's another question, which Marcus kind of alluded to, which is, to what extent will interest continue in Haiti once the immediate danger has passed and the immediate crisis over?
Well, let's talk about Pakistan. Those five U.S. Muslim men are charged with plotting terror attacks in Pakistan. They are U.S. passport holders. It looks like they're going to be seeking life sentences. Where does this case stand in terms of U.S. concerns about terrorism and especially recruiting taking place in the United States, Rob Watson?
Well, I'm not completely familiar with all of the details of this particular case, although I do know of it. I would say this, really, and that is that U.S. concerns are not at the level that they are in the United Kingdom. It's a really good way, it's a good comparison, because in the United Kingdom, here in Britain, pretty much every single major attack has been linked to people of British citizens of Pakistani descent who then made the link back to Pakistan to Al-Qaeda recruiters there. There's a very, very clear pattern. We have hundreds of thousands of British citizens of Pakistani descent who go back to Pakistan for annual visits. So it's a huge problem here. There just hasn't been that scale of problem in the United States. And, you know, I certainly have my own theories about that, that the United States is a country of immigrants, that if you look at the Pakistani community in the United States, its median income is higher than the average white family. So it's just not the same circumstances. But is it something that's probably ringing the odd alarm bell? Well, you betcha.
All right, Rob Watson, political correspondent for the BBC in London, and Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our other partners, the New York Times. They both joined us early this morning for this week's agenda. As the nation commemorates the life and work of civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right.
Well, he certainly proved it by the way that he lived and his legacy. We're asking you this morning, what more does America need to do in order to fulfill Dr. King's dreams? You can tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment on our website, thetakeaway.org. And coming up, parents ever wonder how to best explain scary or tragic events like the Haiti earthquake to young children? We're going to talk about it. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Miles O'Brien, in for Celeste Headlee on vacation this week. It's W-2 time at work. Sorry to tell you that.
Thanks for reminding me there, sorry, Miles. We'd like having you come in.
The cruel reminder. They brought me in for that. The tax season is upon us, so this is a good day to talk about an IRS victory. Why don't we do that? We'll begin on a high note for the tax season. Lori Singleton Clark is a nurse in Maryland. The IRS sued her after she deducted her tuition for an MBA degree. But guess what? Lori won. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, great. And you are obviously doing well. Congratulations. This goes back to 2005, your tax return. You're a nurse. You tried to deduct $15,000 for tuition expenses for an MBA. And on the face of it, I might say, well, wait a minute, you're a nurse. How can you deduct an MBA tuition? How did that work out for you?
Well, actually, that's what the IRS felt as well. I went.
So wait a minute, so you're telling me I think like the IRS? Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Anyway, go ahead.
We don't like to tell them.
Yeah. I went back to school to get an MBA because I wanted to be on the same level with physicians in terms of explaining regulatory and accrediting matters. And my degree is a dual degree. It's an MBA in healthcare management. When the IRS saw that I was taking accounting courses, finance courses, and economic courses, they said, wait a minute, she's studying for a different career field. So my challenge was to explain to the IRS, no, I'm not. I'm actually going to use this information, these courses, to improve my performance at work.
So what that implies is the IRS is, like me, a little bit clueless about what nurses do, huh?
Exactly. Nurses today have expanded roles. And we're in management, we're at the bedside, we're out, you know, handling disasters, et cetera. And my function at that time was to explain to doctors how important their documentation is in making sure that the care they're providing to their patients is appropriate, is timely, and meets regulatory and accrediting bodies.
Laurie, it sounds like you should add lawyer to that, too. I mean, you did this on your own, and you got this MBA degree online, right?
Exactly. And I've gone, my undergraduate degree, I did go to school, you know, physically stay in school. But the master's degree was online, and it was appropriate for me where I was in my, you know, in my life, raising children, working full time. I just physically could not go to a school and sit in a classroom. So
you're amazing that you pulled all this off, and you beat the odds, right? What is it? What, 10% win?
That's what I'm told. I couldn't believe it. It was a personal endeavor. I had no idea that my victory would gain so much attention. But the responses I've gotten have been very positive.
All right, Lori, excellent. Congratulations. Lori Singleton Clark, we'll remember you April 15th.
She's a registered nurse in Maryland. As the nation commemorates the life and work of civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right.
We're asking you, what more does America need to do in order to fulfill Dr. King's dreams? Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org. John Hockenberry here, not with Celeste Headlee, but with Miles O'Brien, which is pretty huge, but even huger than that. Coming up, we've got Danny Glover, who's going to be here, and Corey Smith. They collaborated on a movie called Soundtrack of a Revolution. the songs of the civil rights movement.
You're going to like that one.
Yes, indeed. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Taliban gunmen and suicide bombers have attacked the heart of the Afghan capital, Kabul, in what appears to be a very coordinated attack. The Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, was swearing in members of his new cabinet when the attack began. For the latest, we go now to the BBC's Mark Dummett in Kabul. Mark, we spoke to you earlier this morning. Has there been an all clear from the government, as far as you know?
Well, President Karzai has said that, as far as he's aware, yes, the situation is now under control. And certainly, from where I'm speaking from, which is right in the center of Kabul, close to the buildings which came under attack, I mean, it is very quiet now, and it has been quiet for the past 3 hours, 2 or 3 hours. But still, you know, the city hasn't exactly returned to normal. Many people, I imagine, are too afraid to go out into the streets. And certainly around here, there is a large presence of Afghan soldiers and military.
In the middle of the attack, Richard Holbrooke, the U.S. envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan, said all this proves is that the Taliban won't win. Do you think there's another message to the people of Kabul in this attack from the Taliban?
Well, sure. I mean, I think the Taliban's message is pretty clear. Which is that they can strike right in the heart of the capital. Now, the area which they attacked is home to President Karzai's palace, many government ministries, as well as the main shopping area. There's a very, very big security presence here. There are checkpoints. There are lots of armed guards, security personnel keeping an eye on this part of the town. So they were able to say, look, we can attack even this part, the most secure part of the capital city. On the other hand, they weren't able to successfully attack the presidential palace or the ministries. In the end, they only inflicted damage on pretty soft targets, a cinema, a movie hall, and two shopping malls.
All right, and they used some number of suicide bombers and as many as 20 Taliban soldiers, it's believed. Mark Dummett, BBC correspondent, thanks for that.
To Haiti now, and more U.S. Marines will be joining the relief effort today. Also, former President Bill Clinton, the U.N. Special Envoy for Haiti, is expected to visit the country. Despite the security challenges on the ground, Kenneth Merton, the U.S. Ambassador to Haiti, told NBC News this morning that things are looking up.
The Haitian police, due to their own significant losses, are degraded. You have a UN force which has had its own losses, so they're not able to perform at the level that they probably would like. However, given that, I think things are going reasonably well.
Here in the U.S., the race to succeed Ted Kennedy is down to the wire in Massachusetts. Democrats and Republicans have flooded the state to boost the turnout of voters in their favor. Yesterday, President Obama was in Boston stumping for Democratic candidate Martha Coakley.
I need you knocking on doors. I need you making phone calls. I need you talking to your friends and your neighbors and telling them what's at stake on Tuesday, that every vote matters, that every voice matters.
Those are some of the stories we're following for you this morning.
Shadows and find that eventually there we are, and what we are is still family.
You know, it's hard enough watching those images of Haiti, but throw kids into the picture, and they inevitably see this. What do you tell your kids? You have younger kids.
Well, I have two 11-year-olds, two 8-year-olds, and an infant who's not paying much attention. But I tell you, my kids, what they focus on is the idea that you could be going on in your life, and then, boom, something happens and your house falls on you. That's the thing that's so tough for them.
Yeah, so it's tough. How much do you sugarcoat it? Yolanda Gault-Cavaness, our family contributor, has done some research on this topic. She's here to share some tips with us. And also joining us, David DeRozier, is a 17-year-old volunteer with a Haitian charity, Third World Uprising. He'll explain how getting involved has helped him cope with what's going on. But Yolanda, let's begin with you. It's finding the line between too much information and being, you know, just a little too saccharine, because kids can read right through that.
Oh, they've got huge BS detectors. So my advice is don't sugarcoat it at all, because they will see right through it. It's very tough as a parent. You know, you mentioned the images. They're startling to us. And so you feel like as a mom, as a dad, you're supposed to protect them, but this is a tough road. You can't really protect them from what goes on in the world. So my first thing is, you know your kid better than the expert. Figure out where they are emotionally and meet them right there. If they're talking about the devastation, say, you know what? Yeah, it is. It's awful. It's
awful. You bring up an interesting point. If they're talking about the devastation, if they're not talking, you still should probably bring it up because a kid won't bring it up, right?
Older kids, it's hard. I mean, yeah. My kids are about the same age, actually. It's funny. 11, 9, and then a 2-year-old. And the 11-year-old won't say much. She will kind of, I think she's internalizing it. She's not going to blurt out like the other one will. Oh, my God, Mommy, what will do? And you have to coax it out of them. And sometimes I think what I try to do is I say, empathize. I'm like you. Sometimes when things are really rough, I kind of shut down too. Are you feeling this? Are you feeling that? Because you want to try to get them to talk about it. They need to get it out.
And different ages, you pass through. I remember when my kids were 5, death and sudden death was really a huge issue.
Yeah.
Then they get a little older. They pass out. My 11-year-olds are much more interested in the help idea.
The help idea. Yeah, because I think this is a great notion. I tell you what, let's bring in David DeRosiers now, who is one of those kids who has is found this empowering. He's working with a Haitian charity called Third World Uprising. David, good to have you with us this morning.
Good to be here.
All right, tell us a little bit. Why did you chip in, and how is this helping you out?
Well, basically, I can't say it's helping me out at all. I'm a Haitian myself. And I feel that our Haitian community, we're all Americans here. There are humans out there. All people understand that everybody's a human. People have been explaining to me that, I'm too young for this, I'm too young for that. You must understand, there's people younger than me that's out there getting killed. I have a niece and a nephew. They're 5 and 8. They're out there. My house actually in Haiti is not completely broken down, but everybody's at the church. It's just a very... It traumatized me hearing all this. When my house got the call, they was explaining to us how it was happening. They actually called during the time it was happening. It was like, they explained.
David, you're 17. I have a 17-year-old son as well. What can you do from here to help out?
Well, basically, my first move was contacting my school. My second move was contacting my community centers. My third move was just contacting everybody else who was older than me, because me, I'm just exactly like you said, I'm just 17. If you could get somebody older that can help you, it'll definitely make people see it as a bigger idea. Once you have older people behind you, more people will come behind you.
Thank you, Yolanda. That's a key point, isn't it? That's empowering.
I have to commend him for what he's doing.
Give him credit for that.
Exactly. It's unreal. And you know what, though? I mean, I know that his devastation, it's not focused on what he's doing, but that is healing in some way. You take some actionable step to do something. And you can encourage your kids no matter how old they are. He says he's only 17, which is amazing. But even a 2 or 3-year-old can go online with you and can go onto the Red Cross site or can go on to, Architecture for Humanity and donate and see what they can do, can help raise, the Brownies can help raise money with clothing drives. And
kids
such.
Are little problem solvers. They love to
they
see
love
the problem
that.
And see the
They
solution.
Love that. Yep. It makes them feel so good. And lean on your faith and just keep talking to them and keep reassuring them. Hugs, extra kisses, spending time with them. That kind of stuff is really what's going to go the long way.
David, I'm curious. You talk about how you've sort of leaned on adults to help you out. What about your peers, fellow teens? What are they doing?
Well, basically, they hear what I'm doing, and they ask, how can they get involved, David? What can I do, et cetera, et cetera. I tell them that you can donate clothes, money, et cetera. I'm going to Haiti myself, so I'm going directly to Haiti. So I'm going from Dominican Republic to Haiti. Therefore, whatever I can bring with me, I will bring with me, and I will help the Haitian people.
When are you going?
I'm supposed to be going this Sunday or the Sunday after that.
All right, we wish you well down there. Please be safe and keep up the good work. David DeRosiers and Yolanda Galt-Cavaness, thank you very much.
Today the country remembers Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and the Haitian crisis sort of puts it into focus.
I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Dr. King's famous and sadly final speech in honor, we're asking you, has America made it to the promised land?
If Martin Luther King were alive today, I think he would be 100% pro-life, and he'd work for the civil rights of the unborn.
What's your take? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment on our website at takeaway.org. Our podcast is always on. You can subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Miles O'Brien.
This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Day 7 in Haiti.
I've seen so many people who pass away in front of my eyes, and so many dead people. And so right now, all we need is help. We need help. We're crying for help.
The cries for help, some get louder, some get angry, some go silent. Haiti's outstretched arms, the international community's overstretched aid effort. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. Monday, January 18th, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. I'm here with Miles O'Brien, who's filling in for Celeste Headlee all week. The takeaway really is that overstretched relief effort in Haiti, I think.
I should say, and once again, just getting your hands around the magnitude of the problem is so difficult. Let's get right to those top stories, and we're going to start in Afghanistan. Explosions and machine gun fire rattled the city of Kabul this morning. A group of Taliban militants tried to storm the presidential palace and some other government buildings just as President Karzai was swearing in his new cabinet. The militants fanned out, taking up positions on rooftops before Afghan troops were able to take some control of the situation hours later. The U.S. Special Envoy for Afghanistan, Richard Holbrooke, says...
It's not surprising that the Taliban do this sort of thing. They're ruthless.
Officials say at least five people were killed and nearly 40 wounded. Seven of the attackers were also killed. The situation is ongoing. On to Haiti now, where desperate survivors are scrambling for food, water, and medical supplies. The European Union pledged nearly $600 million to help those affected by last week's earthquake. Meanwhile, thousands of U.S. troops are expected to arrive off the coast of Haiti's devastated city of Port-au-Prince today to help relief organizations get supplies to survivors. They'll also be reinforcing 1,000 U.S. troops now on the ground.
Now, they're talking about thousands of U.S. troops, and of course they're talking about 100,000, maybe more, dead when all is said and done in Haiti, and they'll be a long time until that is the case. But we're going to be focusing in just a moment on the stories, the individual stories, which sort of speak volumes about what the experience is of being in Haiti right now as a reporter and as one of the civilians desperately in need of help. Here's the BBC's Matthew Price.
Do you have enough food? Do you have enough water?
No, I don't have no food, no water.
What do you need from the international aid organizations?
The light.
You need electricity, light?
The light. And food, the water.
Food and water.
Yeah.
Light, food, and water. We're going to have more stories of the aid efforts into Haiti in just a few minutes.
The fate of President Obama's health care overhaul could depend on who will fill the Massachusetts Senate seat left vacant by Ted Kennedy's death. The president traveled to Boston yesterday, where he needs Democratic candidate Martha Coakley to win in order to block a Republican filibuster in the Senate. But Coakley's lead has evaporated under a strong challenge by Republican Scott Brown.
Martha's going to make sure you get your money back. She's got your back. Her opponent's got Wall Street's back.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says the stakes are high for Republicans as well.
This is, in effect, a referendum on the national health care bill.
A Brown win would give Republicans 41 Senate votes, enough to filibuster the health care bill.
At the Golden Globes last night, Avatar won Best Film Drama, while James Cameron took home Best Director. Other winners include Meryl Streep, big surprise, as Julia Child in Julia and Julia and Julia, and Robert Downey Jr. won for Sherlock Holmes. Precious, the movie, also won an award there. All kinds of things there at the Golden Globes. TV shows as well. You can go to our website and find out who the winners are. Today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
Our God is marching on. Yeah. Glory, hallelujah.
Yeah,
glory, hallelujah.
Go to our website and leave a comment on this. We're asking, what's the next step for the civil rights movement in America? Where are we lacking as a nation? And what more does our country need to do to fulfill Dr. King's dream? You know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can leave a comment at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, the struggles for survival, one human soul at a time in Haiti.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Got a couple of numbers for you, Miles O'Brien, in here for Celeste Headlee. Mm-hmm. Thinking about Haiti, it's expected that there may be as many as 12,000, nobody knows for sure, troops on the ground to help in the relief effort from U.S. forces trying to get troops airlifted there to Haiti. But the death toll, which we also don't know much about, could top 100,000 at the end of the
That's
day.
That's a frightening number, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah, well, to deal with the effort, I mean, to really get some sort of context, you really can't focus on those numbers. You have to focus on the individual stories. Nick Davis from our partner, the BBC, joined us earlier from Haiti. I asked him if those numbers, if the 12,000 U.S. troops are going to increase the visibility of that relief effort on the ground.
I'd say so. I mean, at the moment, I'm not sure if you can hear it on air, but there's a helicopter, a U.S. military helicopter, hovering not far away. It's a visible presence like that, which will, in many cases, make the security of the teams operating here, not only military but civilian, a whole lot easier.
And, you know, we were actually in some discussions earlier on in the program about this notion that we've heard in media reports that security is likely to deteriorate, might deteriorate as the pace of the relief effort seems to be so slow so far. What are you getting? Because we're also hearing from Haitians who say, no, it's going to be fine. Haitians are good at working these things out.
Very much so. I have to say that so far my experience has been that the Haitians have been a most resilient people in terms of what they're dealing with, maybe because of the fact that they've gone through this sort of scenario, not an earthquake of this magnitude, not a death toll of this magnitude either, and it is huge, as you said, 100,000, up to 100,000 expected to be dead. But people are somehow finding a way to cope. While the aid isn't getting through, Haitians are doing it for themselves. They're actually just going out there and trying to survive. The way they have done in the past, the international community hasn't actually... they've put in a lot, but even so, this country has always needed a lot of work to be done, and they just go out and try and survive the best they can.
Well, Nick Davis, BBC reporter, thanks so much. On the ground live there from Port-au-Prince, Haiti. And really, that's the story this morning, that resilience, the sense of people taking matters into their own hand. The stories are grimly repetitive, yet each of them unforgettable. People who lost so much in the first shocks of last week's earthquake clinging to life as the relief effort moves forward at an agonizingly slow pace. I want you to listen for the sadness in our colleague, BBC reporter Mark Doyle's voice, as he comes upon a man here who is in Haiti for an already tragic reason and who has no idea how to put back the pieces of his life now.
My name is Wiss Mattis. I'm living in New York, so I'm here for the funeral of my mother. The funeral was last Saturday. Then the scene happened on Tuesday. I lost my wife.
I'm sorry.
And I buried my wife yesterday. So I'm planning to go now. I don't have no passport, no nothing, you know, and I want to go.
If you want to tell me what happened in your house and...
At my house?
Yes.
Oh, well, I was at my house at the time, you know, the thing happened. Then I was right here by outside there when the thing happened, you know, when I hear the, boom, you know, just like a bulldozer, you know, and I run down there and...
And your wife was inside the house?
Yeah. My wife and my cousin, I don't know. Oh, just about, I don't know, God. Believe me, that's God. And... Well, after that, my wife passed away after 2 days.
So she was hit by the rubble that fell?
Yeah,
and
the top off.
She was very badly injured, and then she died subsequently?
She died right away. And
right away. Any medical attention here? Any nurses?
Nothing at all. Nothing at all. We don't have no aid, no nothing at all. No food, no water, no medical, no doctor, nothing at all. You are the first one who visited us, sir.
You were the first one to visit us. That's Mark Doyle visiting for the first time, a man waiting for help, telling his tragic story. The BBC has a whole team on the ground, each one with story after story of this kind of resilience of Haitians dealing with the aftermath of last week's earthquake. We take you now to a story from the BBC's Mike Thompson.
An elderly woman approaches me in a particularly poor and devastated suburb of Port-au-Prince. Her face contorted with a mixture of anger and pain.
I'm very hungry. We're all in the same situation. Our home has been destroyed. We don't have anywhere to sleep. Don't you see where we're sleeping? We don't have any food to give the children. We wish they could help us. The smell of these dead bodies are killing us. I believe the germs of these dead bodies are going to make all of us sick.
This feeling of neglect is common here, despite pledges from countries around the world to come to Haiti's aid.
Hard to find water, we don't have electricity, and living is very hard.
Can you tell me what help you've had so far? Because there are quite a lot of soldiers here now. What help have they given you?
We didn't find help from them yet.
Have you had any help at all here?
No, right now, no. Right now, no. Nothing. We don't have nothing ourselves. Nothing.
We leave you with this final story from the BBC's Mike Thompson, a neighborhood finding itself in the rubble.
A man in his 30s, wearing a bright but dusty yellow shirt, leads me through a small, rubble-strewn alley, littered by fallen masonry and twisted metal cables. Suddenly, he stops.
Over there's some people who are trying to take some dead bodies from that house. They've been doing this some hours before we pass here.
How many people have you lost in the community here?
We cannot reckon, there's a lot. We don't know how much about people we've lost, because there's a lot of people under the houses that crashed down, you know?
Do you think any of the people still trapped might be alive?
I don't know if they're alive, because we was looking for some survivors, but we didn't hear none from them. All we find is dead bodies, and we take them out, so they might be sticking in a time, so they might be decomposing. So that's why we take them out, and we just put them out.
First, I see a small woman's shoe, and then what looks like a foot protrudes from under a cracked concrete slab. I listen, but can hear no signs of life from beneath the rubble.
I've seen so many people who pass away in front of my eyes, and so many dead people. And so right now, all we need is help. We need help. We're crying for help.
The BBC's Mike Thompson there witnessing, as his colleagues and all of us are, the tragedy unfolding in Haiti. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on the other stories we're following.
There's new information on how many were killed in this morning's gun battle in the Afghan capital of Kabul. Afghan forces say on the ground, 9 attackers were killed, 4 Afghan security officers and 1 child. The city is now calm, but there is some concern that some of the Taliban attackers may still be at large in the city. There's been swift reaction from the U.S. this morning. The U.S. envoy to the region, Richard Holbrooke.
It's not surprising that the Taliban do this sort of thing. They're desperate people. They're ruthless. The people who are doing this certainly will not survive the attack, nor will they succeed. But we can expect this sort of thing on a regular basis. That is who the Taliban are.
The UN has warned that acute fuel shortages in Haiti could have serious implications for the humanitarian situation there. The UN also says hospitals in Haiti and in the neighboring Dominican Republic are overwhelmed with casualties. Then there's the worsening security situation. Here's Lieutenant General Ken Keene of the U.S. Southern Command.
We've had incidents of violence that impede our ability to support the government of Haiti.
Here at home, the fate of President Obama's health care overhaul could depend on who will fill that Massachusetts Senate seat left vacant by Edward Kennedy's death. Democrats and Republicans are ramping out to get out the vote ahead of a special election tomorrow where it's really all on the line. Let's look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, commemorating the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we're going to speak to Columbia Law Professor Patricia Williams on the past, present, and future of the American Civil Rights Movement.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway, from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
We're going to get some more details now of the gunfighting this morning in Kabul. You can hear some of it this morning. We're presenting to you the sound when the capital of Kabul in Afghanistan erupted in gunfire with the Taliban, with suicide bombers and fighters with rifles and rocket-propelled grenades fought to the death only 50 feet from the gates of the presidential palace. Joining us with more details is New York Times correspondent Dexter Filkins in Kabul. This was an attack both brazen and suicidal in equal measure, but it certainly sends a disturbing message to the people of Kabul, Dexter.
Yes, it does. I think it was a very brazen attack, but I think, you know, fortunately in this case, there were only two civilians and three soldiers killed. And in something like this, I think had the attack succeeded, you would have had a lot more people killed. It was a suicide bomber tried to get into the central bank, which is right next door to President Karzai's office, and he had a suicide belt on. And if he would have gotten inside, there were six guys who would have come in behind him with guns and another suicide bomber, and they would have, you know, killed any number of people. It was very much like the attack they did 11 months ago on the Ministry of Justice, which is actually just about 50 feet away on the other side. So I think, you know, it was a crazy scene downtown, paralyzed the Capitol for several hours, huge gun battle. The Capitol's pretty vulnerable, there's no question about it, but I think the government here, the Afghan government, and they did all the fighting today. I didn't see any Americans. They're satisfied they're happy at least that they foiled what could have been a much worse attack.
Well, let's look at some of the numbers. I mean, within the hour, we've learned that Afghan forces are saying that nine attackers were killed, four Afghan security officers killed, one child, one civilian killed. There may be more civilians killed or injured. I mean, in a sense, those numbers are small, but is this an argument for the U.S. having a bigger presence in Kabul?
I don't think so. I mean, this is all about intelligence and about, you know, who's trying to get into the city and why. I think for the people who are listening out there, I think the best way to sort of look at the war, which is very different from Iraq, or if you remember, the whole war was pretty much fought in Baghdad in the capital.
Sure.
That's not true here. Kabul is usually very quiet. The insurgency is in the countryside. It's a rural insurgency. Most of the American soldiers are in the countryside. So, you know, with some regularity and with increasing regularity, the Taliban are trying to get people into the capital to strike fear into people's hearts here, and that's what they did today. But on most days, Kabul, the capital, is pretty quiet and pretty safe.
So, I mean, of course, as we know, Dexter Filkins, a New York Times reporter, you have a reputation for being a pretty straight shooter. Nevertheless, what you're saying seems to corroborate or back up what Richard Holbrooke, the Afghanistan-Pakistan envoy, was saying this morning, that this is purely a sign that the Taliban is losing in the countryside and is making a desperate attempt to disrupt things in Kabul.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I think, you know, the Taliban is what it is in the countryside. It's pretty strong. They're mounting more attacks than they ever have before since 2001, when the war began. Twice the number of American soldiers and Marines died in 2009 as in 2008. The Taliban are very strong. This is not a sign of their weakness. It's a sign of their strength, that they can come into the capital whenever they want and strike, as I said, 50 feet away from the president's house.
So finally, if I was a civilian on the ground in Kabul today, would I be more or less cynical about the ability of Afghan forces to protect me?
I think you'd be more. But I mean, again, this is a spectacular attack, and it was meant to be. It was meant to draw attention. It was meant to kill a lot more people than it did. But again, I think what's different about this attack is, on most days, Kabul is very quiet. The war here is in the countryside. It's just outside of town. So for the residents of Kabul, for the most part, have it pretty good compared to
compared to people in the rest of the country.
All right, New York Times correspondent Dexter Filkin sorting out the complicated and a large number of messages delivered by the Taliban to the people of Afghanistan, the government of Afghanistan, and NATO forces fighting in Afghanistan. He joined us live from Kabul. Thank you, Dexter.
Of course, today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and this weekend, our partner station, WNYC Radio, hosted a celebration for the holiday in New York City. Our Celeste Headlee co-hosted the event before she went on vacation. This morning, we're bringing you some of the civil rights activists and educators she spoke with.
My name is Patricia Williams. I am a professor of law at Columbia University Law School, and I also write a column for The Nation magazine entitled Diary of a Mad Law Professor.
So as a professor, you obviously come in contact constantly with the next generation who are going to be graduating college and setting out on their own. And what do you tell them? What is the next great battle for civil rights?
Well, I think that the next battle of civil rights is going to be a technological one. It's going to be about DNA collection. It's going to be about surveillance and cameras. I think there's also going to be a push for the internationalization of the civil rights movement, as well as for the diversification of the civil rights movement, which includes not simply the old black-white model, but also the question of a variety of people of color, minorities, including religious and ethnic minorities, linguistic minorities, and I think also immigration rights are going, as the resources of the planet become more and more in question or limited, I think that our borders are going to be the frontier of the civil rights movement.
That was Professor Patricia Williams, a law professor at Columbia University Law School, speaking to Celeste Headlee.
See my old friend Martin, can you tell me where he's gone?
We're asking you all morning, what's left to fulfill in the dream of Martin Luther King on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day? You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, a provocative conversation with the mayor of New York. Michael Bloomberg is going to be here to talk about how you boost volunteerism in the middle of a recession.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up,
this is Mike Bloomberg, and you're listening to The Takeaway.
His Honor joins us to talk about a new program designed to boost volunteer work in New York City. That interview is right after the headlines. And here's what we're looking at this morning. The five Americans being held in Pakistan on suspicion of terrorism had this to say as they were being driven from court today. Police and prison authorities are denying any mistreatment, however. The five Americans were detained in December after being accused of plotting terror attacks in Pakistan and having links to Al-Qaeda.
The worldwide effort to rescue battered Haiti entered its second week today, with thousands of frustrated Haitians saying they're still waiting for food. The UN World Food Program plans to distribute 200 tons of food today, enough for about 100,000 people. But despite this kind of effort, survivors continue to tell tales of neglect in the days after the earthquake. Here's Jean-Yvon Kernizan, a survivor, speaking to us earlier on The Takeaway.
Up until we left on Thursday night, we had not seen one single soldier even directing traffic.
Things are improving today, though. The U.S. 82nd Airborne has arrived. Its 900 troops will focus on restoring security to Port-au-Prince. Meanwhile, the aid group Doctors Without Borders says the main problem keeping relief supplies from reaching the people is a bottleneck at the airport. Spokesman Dr. Greg Elder says the few medical facilities and personnel aren't anywhere near enough.
We're all just overwhelmed. We've got, lists of 300, 400 people waiting for surgery, and the shortage is just having enough operating blocks and enough surgeons to do the work.
Traffic at the airport continues to improve, with 100 planes now flying in and out each day. In Afghanistan, that's the sound of gunfire echoing in the streets of Kabul this morning after a group of armed Taliban militants tried to storm the presidential palace and some other government buildings. Two of them detonated suicide bombs while the rest fought to the death only 50 feet from the gates of the presidential palace. Officials say at least five people were killed, nearly 40 wounded. Seven of the attackers were also killed. Let's take a quick look at the markets. Asian markets were down. European indices are up slightly. U.S. markets are closed for the holiday. Those are some of the stories we're following for you this morning.
So as Miles said there at the top of the segment, the we are pleased to be joined by Mayor Michael Bloomberg of the city of New York, who is on his way to Chicago to unveil a program that a number of mayors are involved in around the country, something which certainly is invoked by this holiday, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. The spirit of volunteerism certainly pervaded the civil rights movement, people working selflessly to try to increase the rights for Americans. But in these tough economic times, what is the challenge to boost volunteerism in a city like New York? Here to talk about that is Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Good morning, Mr. Mayor.
Good morning, John. Miles, thank you for having me. I can't think of a better time to boost volunteerism than when the economic times are tough. That's when people need help, and that's when those who want to help are focused on it. And so it's a natural time to pull together and to harness one of the great resources that we have, and that's the drive and creativity and dedication of the average American.
And I guess, you know, we're seeing that resource mobilized in the response to the earthquake in Haiti, and I think some have said that more needs to be done because of the level of the devastation. But how do you avoid the message that, you know, the last thing that people who are out of work need now is calls to go volunteer, that, you know, the actual work is what people really need, not necessarily short-term volunteerism? How do you supplant that message?
Well, more than one person out of work said to me that, you know, I'm out of work, I'm looking for a job, but I have the time to volunteer. I don't want to waste the time. I'd rather be working, obviously, but while I'm waiting to find a job, what better than to spend my time making this a better city, state, country, world?
Well, let's hold on to that for a second. So you're hearing from people who are unemployed, who have free time, who want to make the most of this transitional moment. What is the infrastructure that you and some other mayors around the country are putting in place to try to boost this?
Well, back last September, we started a coalition of cities with 17 mayors, and I'm going out to Chicago right after we finish this interview to be with 80 of them. And these 80 city mayors have gotten together and said, you know, the president asked us to have a new era of service. The president pointed out we face great challenges, but the people want to help, and what we've got to do is pull things together. Cities are very different than private organizations in that cities represent an enormous number of people. They have resources at their disposal. They have the bully pulpit. But what we've got to do is make sure that we can connect those who want to volunteer with those who run the organizations that provide the services and make sure that the volunteers' time is well spent. And so whether you want to go and knock on the doors of our senior citizens and say, get your flu shot, or whether you want to help paint the roofs of your buildings white that'll reflect energy and reduce the amount of energy consumption and our carbon footprint and our dependence on foreign oil, whether you want to teach people how to do CPR or mentor a child in school or plant trees. You know, there's thousands of things that you can do, and lots of people who want to help. But the problem has always been they don't know where to go. And so what we've done here in New York is we've hired a person to run our woman, Diane Billings Burford, who's our chief service officer, as far as I know, the first one in the country. And then thanks to the Rockefeller Foundation, we're going to announce today 10 cities out of 50 that applied who will be getting a couple $100,000 grant so that they can go and hire their own. And this person's job is to pull together those who want to reach out and those that want to be reached out to, getting things together. And you can also do some things like common vetting and helping volunteer organizations buy in bulk to reduce their expenses. There are a whole bunch of things that, that we can do. I can't think of a better day to kick it off than Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday.
Well, let's step back for a second and talk about that chief service officer. It's really a management model that's been one of your successes here as you're beginning your third term as New York mayor. The 311 number model, where you consolidate the helplines of a variety of government agencies under one roof and under one sort of symbolic address where you go to get help. Is that really the model here, to consolidate the a number of volunteer opportunities at one location so that people can quickly find out what they would want to do?
Well, I think the question is, what is your objective? If you really want to help people, you have to make sure that with whatever resources that we have, whether they are human resources or monetary resources or the power of the legislators to enact laws, you have to make sure that they're focused on where you can really make a difference, not just where you really feel good or where it's fun to be or get good article in the paper. And so concentrating the expertise of the professionals who know what is needed with the enthusiasm of those who can actually make a difference really will, in the end, help society a lot more than if you just do helter-skelter. So sure, we're trying to instill a accountability and responsibility model, which is exactly what you do in your house or in your school or in your city.
All right. Well, avoiding the pure sort of PR advantage to volunteerism and focusing on what has the best impact, the mayor of New York, they're losing his voice on behalf of the Takeaway on his way out to Chicago to boost a brand new program on volunteerism with 80 other mayors. Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor.
All the best. Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Miles O'Brien, filling in for Celeste Headlee. Last night, the TV and movie stars mingled and the alcohol flowed freely, and I was at home. Golden Globe Awards were handed out.
One-step program, the Golden Globe.
I want to thank all the little people. Our movie contributor, Rafer Guzman, watched, of course. He was up late, and he's here to tell us what he thought about the big night. His predictions from Friday came true, right?
No, actually. I did pretty badly.
I was trying to give you the benefit of the doubt there. You could have picked at least one. Let's, first of all, talk about the host, because we always like to have Ricky Gervais. Let's listen to, he had to do the obligatory late-night comedian joke. Let's listen.
Of course.
Let's get on with it before NBC replaced me with Jay Leno.
kind of low-hanging fruit, but what the heck? How did he do?
I thought he did pretty well. I mean, I think he was there. You know, it's the first time they've had a host since about 15 years, I think. And I think he was there to sort of increase the unpredictability factor. I think he did a pretty good job. He
good behavior, bad behavior. You don't want it to be too good on the behavior.
Yeah, that's
either,
right. That's right. Yeah, he got some good digs in at Paul McCartney, making fun of him flying coach because a veiled reference to his loss of money from his divorce, and good dig in at Mel Gibson for his recent DUI. So he he scored a few barbs.
Did
in
the
there.
Cameron Bigelow marriage, former marriage, come up at all?
It did
no.
not.
They
did
didn't
not.
Go there.
Maybe
too
inside
they would.
Baseball. Yeah, yeah.
So that might be third rail or inside baseball. I don't know. TV categories. Did the right people win?
TV categories. I was mostly focused on the movies. I wasn't following, but I know that that Glee did pretty well, which beating out 30 Rock and Entourage, and Mad Men did well. Although I was surprised to see that Michael C. Hall won for Dexter over John Hamm in the Mad Men for the Best Actor category.
Yeah.
That kind of surprised
cancer,
me.
Right?
Yeah, he wore a black cap, probably to cover his head.
All right, what about movies? Your predictions versus what happened?
Well, do I get any points for predicting the best foreign language film?
Yes, you do. Yes, sure. Yes.
10 points.
All right. Well,
reach
for it, go for it, embrace it.
That's something. That's something. Well, I had picked Up in the Air for Best Picture, right. and I had picked Catherine Bigelow for Best Director.
From Hurt Locker, thinking
they would split the vote. Wrong on both counts.
You didn't see Avatar coming, huh?
I didn't see Avatar coming. Yeah. I don't think I was alone. I think a lot of people were a little surprised by that. I do think it was the right choice, given the competition.
Do you?
Yeah,
really?
I was a huge fan of Avatar. I thought it was a great movie and broke a lot of new ground technologically, obviously. But I thought it was a good movie, and I was glad to see it win.
And, of course, in that case, if you give the movie the nod, you almost have to give Jim Cameron the nod, because he's so in it. Let's listen to him briefly.
This is the best job in the world. It just really is. I just want you to give it up for yourself. We all have the best job in the world.
He's the king of the world.
I think I hate him. there's something so annoying about that.
Not what you call a billion dollars. Not a humble guy, but
to say the least.
I think also one of the big surprises was the best comedy picture, which I think most people would have said Julie and Julia, and The Hangover won. And that really surprised me, because here's just sort of a crass box office hit over a Meryl Streep comedy.
I would put it in a Golden Globe category. I enjoyed the movie. But,
that's great.
I mean, jeez.
But Meryl Streep, big shocker.
Yeah, big shocker. Yeah. Winning for Julie and Julia, right? Right. Competing against herself for It's Complicated.
Her seventh.
Yeah, she was going to win one way or the other.
All right, Rafer Guzman, thanks very much. He's the film critic at Newsday.
and a great aficionado of foreign language films.
Indeed,
did you know?
Yes. Indeed. Oui, oui.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Miles O'Brien in for the vacationing Celeste Headlee.
Good morning.
Coming up, the evocative, the unforgettable music of the civil rights movement revisited for a new generation in a new film, a soundtrack for a revolution. It's called. Actor Danny Glover, who executive produced the film, and Corey Smith, who was the music producer on the documentary, will be here right after the headlines. But first, let's check in on the top stories at 48 minutes after the hour. In Afghanistan, the streets of Kabul were a battlefield this morning. 14 people were killed, according to Afghan government sources, when Taliban suicide bombers and gunmen attacked government and other buildings. Dexter Filkins of the New York Times is in Kabul. He says today's attack shows Kabul is still vulnerable.
The Taliban are trying to get people into the capital to strike fear into people's hearts here, and that's what they did today. But on most days, Kabul, the capital, is pretty quiet and pretty safe.
Over to Haiti, a United Nations spokeswoman says more than 1,700 rescue workers have saved over 70 lives since the quake on Tuesday. Last night, U.S. teams with search dogs rescued a 16-year-old Dominican girl trapped for 5 days in a collapsed hotel. Rick Santos was buried beneath the rubble of another of Haiti's hotels. He said he experienced a wide range of emotions before he was rescued.
Despair and the elation were at different moments. And, you know, I think when it first hit, we were like, okay, we're trapped, but we're alive. And that's something. And so now the question is, how do you stay alive?
The head of the International Monetary Fund has said China and India are leading a global recovery that is faster and stronger than expected. He said the two countries were close to returning to their pre-crisis rates of economic growth. Here at home, the race to succeed Ted Kennedy is down to the wire in Massachusetts. Democrats and Republicans have flooded the state to boost voter turnout ahead of the special Senate election tomorrow. Those are some of the stories we're watching for you this morning.
Nameless bodies you will find. What
it happens every Martin Luther King Day. You hear the I Have a Dream speech and you get those goosebumps listening
every
to those
time.
Iconic words, the iconic sounds, the cadence of his voice. But there were lots of cadences during the civil rights movement. There's actually a soundtrack to the movement. The songs of the time, both protest songs, the songs that come out of a much earlier period in time, and actually songs that remember what Dr. King did, became popular songs in the United States. The soundtrack to the revolution is something my pal Danny Glover knows really well. Actor Danny Glover, good morning.
How you doing, John? How's it going?
It's going great. The civil rights movement has a soundtrack, right?
Yeah, of course it does. You know, all movements do. And this movement has a particular soundtrack, inspiring people in the midst of moments that seem to be dark and while marching in jail. It's quite extraordinary. We're very happy about this.
Well, and it's worth remembering on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, Danny Glover is the executive producer of a documentary called Soundtrack for a Revolution, where today's pop stars remake, it's more than just covering music that was a central part of the civil rights movement, and his collaborator, Danny Glover's collaborator, is Corey Smith, right here in the studio, music producer of that film, Soundtrack to a Revolution. Corey, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, Corey and Danny, how did you decide, first of all, what music to pick? And Corey, let me begin with, it's not just music we're talking about here. We're talking about sounds of the revolution as well as music. And of course, with the sampling technology of today, you've got it all to choose from. Listen to this.
We put his body on a mule train. We were walking along beside, and we sang all of the songs of the movement.
Walking and talking with my mind. Lord, 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 stay.
That's Andy Young speaking about Martin Luther King Jr.'s funeral. Corey, what was it like to use that historical material to interview people from the time and work with the music?
It was a beautiful thing. What we did was we... Bill and Dan had a list of songs from their interviews that we ended up choosing from and selecting certain artists that we felt fit the songs best.
So, now, and when you say Bill and Dan, you mean
Bill? I'm sorry, Bill and Dan were the directors of the film.
Right.
Yeah. So we were able to, at that point, find voices that we fit, that fit certain songs, and also certain contemporary artists that we felt like would be beneficial.
Well, so the song behind Andy Young, speaking there, was Woke Up This Morning, mm-hmm. and you got John Legend
Correct.
To do his own version. Listen to this.
I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. I woke up this
morning. So, Corey,
morning,
what did these artists bring to this? What kind of enthusiasm? Because many of them, you know, were born after a lot of the events here, including, I suspect, yourself.
Yeah, myself was included. Yeah. It was one of those things where a lot of the artists tend to be familiar with the songs through church. Like John was very familiar with this song through church, through his church upbringing. So he was very excited about doing this. You know, John actually flew himself out to do this song on his own dime.
Wow.
You know?
Danny Glover, is this a way of bridging time for people who experience the civil rights movement, for people who only know it historically and through holidays like this?
Well, I think what's important is that we understand this movement, and the music is really a wonderful intro for young people with contemporary artists to understand the power of music, the power of song, and that certainly is evident in any movement. The civil rights movement, given that long journey from slavery to abolition of slavery through the dark years of segregation, etc., the music here resonates. It's a powerful legacy of struggle.
It really compresses time. Phil Oakes wrote the tune Here's to the State of Mississippi as a protest tune, but Wyclef Jean actually does this version in the movie.
Here's to the state of Mississippi, for underneath her borders the devil draws no lines.
You know, what's brilliant about this song, Corey, is he keeps the guitar feel of Phil Oakes,
yeah,
but gives it a totally different feel.
Yeah, you know, he really sat down that day and decided, okay, I wanted to, he was going to actually, you know, redo something in a very unique way. And we were trying our best to not go too far, but you know, allow people to feel, the young people to feel very much, you know, renewed when they hear this these songs in a certain way.
Corey, and then I'm going to ask Danny Glover, and we've got one more song to go out on, but do you have a favorite song of the soundtrack of the Civil Rights Movement?
I'll say one of my favorites is the Roots tune.
The Roots tune?
Yeah.
Okay, well, hold that thought, because we got it right here. Danny Glover, what's your favorite tune of the soundtrack from a Revolution?
Well, certainly the Blind Boy singing, I may not be there. We may not see each other again. I can't remember that first opening.
Yeah, song. No. Well, the Blind Boys are incredible.
The songs from the movie are on
our website, thetakeaway.org. But let's go out on Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I just keep on walking, keep on talking.
Now that tune's been done so many different ways, Corey Smith. That version by The Roots has sort of every quality, the laid-back Southern feel, but the intensity.
Yeah, indeed. You know, it's a very unique thing to see Tariq, the lead singer of The Roots, who normally raps, actually come in and actually sing that song. So yeah. I was very happy. And also the guys from TV on the Radio, another group, actually sang the background vocals. So it was beautiful.
Well, Corey Smith, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Corey Smith is a music producer of the new film Soundtrack to a Revolution, and Danny Glover is the actor and, of course, the executive producer of that new film. Danny, thanks so much for being with us. Happy MLK Day.
Take care.
All right, Danny.
Bye now.
Today, the country remembers Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Goosebumps every time. There is Dr. King in his famous final speech talking about the promised land. In honor of Dr. King's life and work, we're asking, what's the next step for civil rights in America? What else do we need to do to get Dr. King's promised land?
the next step for the civil rights movement is making sure that everybody has the same education throughout the country.
Good suggestion. That was Mike from Detroit. Judith Ackerman has a different take.
The things that we have to do is free Mumia Abu-Jamal, Leonard Peltier, the Move 8, and hundreds of other political prisoners.
Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or on our website, thetakeaway.org. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Miles O'Brien.
This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.